Well, I'm here with Dr. Michael Wayne, and Michael has written a book called Quantum Integral Medicine. And by the way, we're at Dr. Wayne's hotel right now where they're doing construction, so that's what you'll hear in the background a bit. You're a licensed acupuncturist, is that right?
That's right.
You also have a PhD, and you, before we began, said that it was in...
It's in the field, just like the title of my book. The PhD is in quantum integral medicine, and the school I was going to had a interdisciplinary program, so it was actually kind of an organic growth from interdisciplinary studies into this field, what I call quantum integral medicine. And the person who was my mentor ran a program called the School for Paradigm Study. So basically, we were studying paradigms, current paradigm, a new possible paradigm. And that's what kind of, as I said, the organic evolution into this field.
How did you come to acupuncture?
Well, acupuncture, I think when I was in college, and acupuncture really was very low level known in this country at that point.
Right.
But I was studying Asian philosophy, and in Asian philosophy classes, you start learning about a little bit of Chinese medicine. I had a very outstanding teacher. He was kind of a renegade. He was kind of kicked out of the university where I was studying, but he was because of being a very strong mind. And we'll maybe talk a little bit about the dogmatic way of thinking of education. But anyway, I learned about Chinese medicine that way, and became interested in it. Never thought I'd go into that field, but studied it on my own. Then I started receiving acupuncture after a car accident, having back pain. And then I was so impressed that I said, oh, this is good.
So it's actually known rather than acupuncture as traditional Chinese medicine.
Right. Acupuncture is a component of Chinese medicine. Like for myself, I practice acupuncture, Chinese herbal medicine.
Mm-hmm. So you found it useful in the treatment of your injuries from a car accident?
Right, yeah. It was low-level back pain, so maybe I just used it as an excuse to go.
Well, but you know, I'm glad that you found it useful.
Yeah.
How did you find it to differ from the traditional Western allopathic model?
Well, talking about pain, and a lot of people know of acupuncture and the treatment of pain, but acupuncture treats a lot more than just pain, acupuncture in Chinese medicine. But Western medicine really does not do well with pain. They don't do well with a lot of chronic ailments, but pain is definitely not one of their specialties. There's pain management clinics now that are run by anesthesiologists where people get injections of different lidocaines or anti-pain substances, but that's not treating pain, or it is, I guess, in one sense. And Chinese medicine is really about dealing with the qi, the energy, and dealing with that with people really opened dimensions to me in my own exploration. And my exploration into quantum integral medicine really started with the supposition of why people don't heal and what holds their energy back from really opening up. Western medicine has its strengths and lots of weaknesses, but it's really not about the big questions of what holds of healing and what is the nature of healing. It's really about, you know, it's just a technological, biomedicine, a technological medicine. Probably its core weakness is the Western scientific viewpoint, of which Western medicine is a component of the Western scientific viewpoint, and that Western scientific viewpoint is, as he said, that all of life is based on objective observation, not observation, but objective findings. And there is no role for subjectivity. There is no role for mind and consciousness in the equation. So mind and consciousness don't have any role in it. There's definitely an opening up now, more so than ever before. I think we're entering a new frontier in medicine and science and healing and human potential. And that's the core discussion of my book.
Right.
I bring up the analogy in the early 20th century, as quantum physics was being, all these discoveries were being made about the nature of matter that were very different from the Newtonian model, but it actually was about 20 years before a specific quantum theory got laid down, so people had a theory, a foundation to lay it on. But for 20 years, they were making all kinds of very fascinating discoveries and profound discoveries. So this age has been called by some the Quantum Stone Age, in that scientists knew that matter operated differently than they were led to believe, but they didn't have a theory, but they weren't going to throw it out the window and say, oh, we don't have a theory, therefore it can't be true, which modern science tends to do. If we can't touch it and believe it and see it, then it can't exist. The old
Cartesian doubt.
Yeah. So, and I think we're in a kind of a quantum stone age now in terms of healing and human potential. We're seeing people having profound healings. We're seeing people use, you know, more things are occurring that can't be explained by the Western scientific model. And those in the more narrow thinking will say, well, therefore it doesn't exist. We don't believe it could be true.
Right.
But we can't just, again, you can't just take that knee-jerk reaction and kick it out. But we don't have a full theory to really fully explain it yet.
I've been reading on the studies in psychoneuroimmunology by Candace Pert.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
And, it's just wonderful stuff. But she's actually understanding about how, and also the work of Ernest Rossi with a book called Psychobiology of Mind-Body Healing, who was a student of Milton Erickson, where those are people who are very deeply embedded in the Western model, but really have gone to some length to understand how it is a risk for them to step into reporting on what they're observing in terms of how thoughts do produce peptides and neurochemicals, and they do affect the nervous system and the immune system. Is this what you're talking about more with the quantum approach to integral medicine?
Right, that we need to expand the picture that our mind and body, as Candace Pert and many others say, are interconnected, and that the mind is throughout the body. But, I mean, Candace Pert has such strong credentials and really was eloquent with her statements that it really had to be accepted. But we need to expand the medical picture. We don't throw out the Newtonian paradigm. We just expand the model and make it broader in understanding. And that's what I'm saying.
Because there's other traditional Chinese medicine model. There's the Ayurvedic model. There's the holistic model. There's the,
homeopathic model.
Homeopathic, but I'm also thinking about osteopathic model that was developed in England.
Right. So we need to make the umbrella wide enough to be inclusive of all this. There's a term called quantum thinking, and quantum thinking is really about being inclusive of all possibilities. We call it the instead of the Western way would be the either or. It's either this or that. Instead, we say in quantum thinking, it's both this and that.
Because it's a simultaneity.
Right. That all possibilities exist simultaneously.
I saw something in your book talking about the rock logic. And how scary. It's very scary for these Western scientists to depart from, well, this is the absolute, you know.
Yeah, rock logic. That I use the same, I use different terminology to say the same thing, just like you're saying. It's the very narrow-minded approach. For instance, I was on a panel discussion in late February in my area that was...
In New York?
Yeah, upstate New York, in Saratoga Springs. And it was... after a panel discussion, after a showing of the movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? And I was on the panel, and two other people were on the panel. They were professors. One was a physicist, and one was a psychologist. And they both were not happy about the film. And one of the criticisms they had, among many, was, oh, the scientists in the film are fringe scientists. And I just you know, couldn't believe they have the nerve to say that, the gall to say that, because I know Amit Goswami, who was in there, endorsed my book and all this. I know some of those people.
And
to say that was just dismissive of, because it didn't fit into their way of seeing the world. So I rebutted by saying modern day science is now the equivalent of the church of a few hundred years ago, because the church of a few hundred years ago pretty much ruled our way of thinking, told people, you know, it was so dogmatic, and if you rebelled against the church, there were good odds you were going to be burned at the stake. So modern-day science is now the same thing. It's it's scientism, and it's so ingrained in our way of thinking that we don't even realize that we're all part and parcel of that, that it's what is called a mental model. It's not something that's conscious of your, it's not in your conscious mind.
Well, it's actually a state of trance, in my opinion, in my studies of hypnosis.
Right. Yeah. It's below there, and it informs you. It colors the way you see the world. Mm-hmm. The Institute of Noetic Sciences wrote a book a few years ago, The Metaphysical Foundations of Modern Science. And they meant metaphysical in the same way that it's that underneath our physical mind is this way, these assumptions we make of how we see the world, and we don't even realize it. So when people say something like, right, like something is counterintuitive, like quantum physics is quantum counterintuitive, or something else is counterintuitive, what that means is that the precise meaning of that is that it runs against your mental model. It runs against how you see the world, so it's counterintuitive.
All the presuppositions one
right.
has.
So instead, we need to create a new intuition so that we don't see the world, so things aren't counterintuitive, but we start expanding our understanding of the world.
Which actually, many of the ancient civilizations of China and India, to mention just two, have really understood for millennia.
Right, yeah. It's
without perhaps the exquisite capabilities of now being able to focus molecularly and atomically and even quantumly mm-hmm. on the actual phenomena that's occurring. Can you speak about the quantum vision?
Mm-hmm. We need to expand our way of seeing the world, incorporate a quantum vision, incorporate, and this would be whether the scientific world, you don't have to be a scientist to accept it, but somehow ingrained in our logic, to make our logic broader. There's two types of logic. There's narrow logic, which is the type of logic we see and many people rebel against. But then there's broad logic, the logic that's willing to ask the deeper questions or just understand there are deeper levels. And so the quantum vision would be part of that broader vision. Even the understanding about daily life, how the quantum vision interacts in our daily life, which are best summed up in the laws of chaos sciences and complexity.
Chaos and third.
Right. And there's even a science called quantum chaos. But that integration starts making things broader to the point, then you have to, once you get so broad like that, it's so easy to bring spirituality into the picture. And that's where you get the super scientist, like you say, Robert Thurman's talking about. I in my book, I mentioned how the Dalai Lama once said if he wasn't a monk, he'd like to be an engineer.
Well, but in a way, he is.
Right, right. He's like a broad scientist. A scientist, really, at its core, a scientist is a person who seeks the truth. And that could be, I think all of us in one way or another are seeking the truth. Some of us are seeking the truth of paying our bills every day, and some of us are seeking right. the truth of deeper questions. But we're all seeking knowledge. And yoga is about the science of knowledge. So the question, if you're going to seek the truth and be a scientist and seek knowledge, how can you stop at the dog? How can you just dismiss things? In medicine, how can you dismiss people who heal? Or how can you just dismiss things
spontaneously,
that are,
right.
Right. And how can you dismiss things that are outside the Western medical paradigm as just hogwash, just so flippantly? You're not a real scientist, and you're not seeking the truth. And that's the core of logic and truth, is seeking the true answers.
Well, and I can imagine how people become fearful and uncomfortable in expanding a paradigm that they have really invested a lot of energy and effort and ego, actually.
Right. That's what it comes down to. In the course of doing research for my book, I interviewed a lot of people. The interviews aren't in the book, but just to help inform me, mm-hmm. I was asking questions. And one of the questions I asked people, and these were people who were studying with me, was, what do you think holds people back from realizing more of their human potential?
Right.
And most of the people, maybe 9 out of 10 or whatever, the large percentage, just said fear. It's fear that holds us back. Fear from that expansion. Because, and actually, I have a quote in my book because
Please.
I talk about the fear of infinity. And I came across this great quote from a South American short story writer who's no longer alive, Jorge Luis Borges. And he wrote an essay, Avatars of the Tortoise. And I thought it was brilliant what he said. He said, there's a concept which corrupts and upsets all others. I refer not to evil, whose limited realm is that of ethics. I refer to the infinite. Uh-huh. So I thought, he's so right on. It's that infinite. It's that I mean, the fear of what's out there.
People were so afraid of the infinite when Giordano Bruno, then another thing that you spoke about in your book, that they burned him at the stake.
Right. He burned him at the stake. And Galileo, who's a colleague of Bruno, would have been burnt at the stake too, but he recanted. I mean, the church knew it was going to be bad PR if they burned him because he was a best-selling author, but they were still willing to. But he recanted, had house arrest, and 350 years on the 350th anniversary of his birth, the church apologized to him. Pope John Paul II, who just passed away, was the one who apologized to the legacy of Galileo.
Yeah,
amazing.
So yes, so we're actually then flat up against this new way, for Westerners anyway, of attending to what life is, what humans are, particularly with the quantum vision.
Right.
And one of the things that I also urge our readers to get your book and take a look at it, because I was so appreciative at how thorough and yet how accessible you've made all the pertinent discoveries and the steps of those discoveries.
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I had the audience of scientists and general public both in mind, and and that's why I have it well footnoted in research, because I wanted the scientists not to be able to dismiss it and say, where's this guy coming from?
Well, but they're going to do that.
Maybe I shouldn't have thought it.
But you have done your homework, in a traditional sense, to say, okay, if you want to find the source, here it is.
Right, yeah, I wanted them to say, this is, I mean, if they're willing to seek the truth, then, and not dismiss things.
One of the things that was also very curious to me is non-locality and Bell's theorem. Can you talk to us about Bell's theorem and non-local healing in medicine and distant healing?
Right. Oh, that's a big subject, and that goes to
that's
the
outside
core
of a local.
Of,
I mean, a conventional model.
That even Einstein had troubles with non-locality, because non-locality is at the core of the quantum vision. Matter spreads out in its base state. Matter spreads out across the universe in infinite positions. And in these infinite positions, the matter or matter waves, whatever type of word you want to use, consciousness, information, it communicates with each other and it talks to one another in its own native language, its resonance through consciousness. But this communication occurs faster than the speed of light, so it's considered non-locality.
Instantaneous.
So at the core of our beings, then, we also have that, which is, so we can call that non-local mind. Mm-hmm. But Einstein was a little troubled by it, but physicist John Bell, was able to prove, he was one of the first to prove that non-locality is a true scientific fact, and his experiments were recreated many times over. Right, but he... See if I can find the quote. Bell said about his findings, and I have his quote in there. My theorem answers some of Einstein's questions in a way that Einstein would have liked the least. So he was able to show we live in a non-local universe, and with that, much research has now been done. The Institute of Noetic Sciences is always doing very fascinating research in that regard. Larry Doocy has written eloquently many books on non-local mind and what he calls non-local medicine, which he talks about as the new era of healing.
The distant healing is really interesting to me.
Distant healing is something that we could explain by non-local medicine, non-local mind.
Have you worked with that at all?
Yeah, I've researched it. I've been very curious about it. I've read studies with it because they've been written in medical journals now. I was reading even remote viewing would be considered part of that non-local. Right. So it's not even just non-distance healing, but it's really about the capabilities of the human mind, maybe more than mind, the mind, not the brain, mind, which as we that Candace Pert knows is talks about is throughout the body, but the capabilities of the human existence or the integral human, whatever type of word you want to use, not just for distance healing, but for the non-locality and for the greater potentials of the human being.
Right.
So non-locality, I think, is one key to that, to understanding what it is.
Have you had personal experience as a physician doing non-local healing or distance healing with clients?
Yeah, I sometimes I think about, I haven't done sessions myself on it. I know people who do, but there are connections I feel with people. They're just sometimes out of the blue. I just think of somebody and either something comes to me that I know will help them or just the thought of it helps them. And then it brought to mind an interesting story, written by Lawrence Lachan, who's a pioneer in mind-body medicine. In one of his books, he told the story of he was doing his own distance healing experiments with people, and he had one person who was slated for surgery, who wanted him to do a distance healing for him before going in for surgery. So Lawrence Lachan said, "Okay," they set a time, and 2 days later, the person called and said, "Oh, Dr. Lachan, thank you so much. I don't need surgery. The profound healing you just did for me, it was just amazing." And the doctors called Dr. Lachan up and were saying, "We want you to write this in a medical journal." And he goes on to say very, very humorously, he goes, "This would have been the most miraculous healing of the century, except for one thing. In the rush of doing things, I forgot our appointment." And that gets into a whole question of what is the nature of healing. You know, the cynics would say, "Oh, the person just expected it and kind of like tricked their mind into thinking it." But
in the traditional placebo response, but
right?
There's a lot more to that than the doctors coming
absolutely.
To understand.
Herbert Benson, who's another pioneer in mind-body medicine,
relaxation response,
right? And he's called the placebo effect the remembered wellness. And he says that it's really what he feels the mechanism is that the ingrained in the body is a knowledge, a memory of what wellness is, what true healing is, and that it's just the placebo is a trigger mechanism to tap into it. Mm-hmm. So even with that person, with Dr. Lachan, the person triggered his own mechanism. So I think that also is the frontiers of medicine, the ability for non-locality of our own capabilities as we expand our own capabilities and as we go beyond our scientific medical model that is having us so ingrained and locked in.
Well, in that remembered wellness, do you not deal with that in traditional Chinese medicine in, for example, taking the pulses and understanding the disposition of the, I guess there's five substances and within the organs, you know, and in the meridians, is there not almost an energy hologram that you work with?
Right. I think ingrained in Chinese medicine, just as we were talking about, like traditional forms of medicine, understood that. It's understood that there's a mechanism in the body, and Chinese medicine is dealing with it. Chinese medicine is all about the gray areas of life and the human body. So it is dealing with the waveforms, the pulses that the body, the frequencies that the body operates on, and trying to deal with it. Trying to feel the energy, understand the energy.
And be able to dance with that.
And dance with it at a much more profound level. But medicine, you know, we say Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, homeopathic medicine, Native American medicine, Western medicine. But medicine, I think, that's almost divides us sometimes by all those different words. Medicine, at its core, is just medicine. It's an art. The art of healing, and I don't think it matters so much what stripes the person wears. It's really about the resonance with the individual and helping the individual cultivate their own innate healing capabilities. And I think people heal ultimately by them on their own, but sometimes they need a facilitator. And that facilitator could be a brain surgeon who has just a very wonderful manner. Maybe it doesn't happen too often, but it potentially could. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a Chinese medicine practitioner could have a very linear Newtonian mindset, and a brain surgeon could have a very holistic mindset. So it's not necessarily the stripes you wear. It's the core of the person, their heart, their compassion, mm-hmm. and how they connect with the person.
Well, and I do appreciate you're using many terms in that I'm familiar with in the domain of hypnotherapy about the establishment of rapport.
Uh-huh.
And in a fashion, the establishment of that rapport with the remembered wellness
mm-hmm.
perhaps is a mechanism that invites the patient or the client to return to this state of health, of optimum functioning. And I know that many people have really come to these new ways of thinking outside the box, outside the normal Western box, because the drugs that are being unfortunately substituted for much of good medical practice and technique just aren't working. People with any number of ailments, when dealt with, what is it, the typical HMO doctor sees a patient 8 to 12 minutes, is that right?
Yeah, that's
really curious.
There's no chance to connect with the person.
Right.
I know there are MDs who are trying to get away from the insurance model and are just not taking insurance until they can have that flexibility to spend time with people, because that's mm-hmm. the only way, often the most important way to connection is just having the time to listen
right.
for the human interaction.
Certainly, I would like to urge our listeners to get your book and take a look at it. Is it on Barnes & Noble right now? And
it's online, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. It had just come out, so it's just going to be getting into bookstores.
Okay.
There's an 800 number through my distributor, Book Clearinghouse, which is 800-431-1579.
Okay.
And people can also go to the ithinkbooks.com, ithinkbooks.com, or even to my website, quantumintegralcenter.com. But one way or another, people can hopefully find it.
I think it's really important, and this is a really well-written, accessible, I said that before, to a layperson, I believe, of some of the new, of how many of the discoveries in Western science have led up to this new way of approach that is actually outside of thinking.
Right, and I wanted to make it accessible, easy to read, and I wanted to make it as practical. And one of the things I talk about is how our educational system really kind of self-perpetuates our way of thinking. I mean, many of our institutions
right.
self-perpetuate our way of thinking, that kind of closed thinking, and our educational system is one of the is definitely a chief perpetrator of that very closed mm-hmm. end way of seeing the world.
So it's about re-educating yourself.
Yeah, re-educating yourself. I don't know what we can do about the educational system, but if we can re-educate ourselves, open up our mind,
right.
we're so easily taught how to criticize and be critical and be negative and kind of be locked in. But how often are we taught how to think creatively, how to think open-mindedly, how to think in a very non-linear, dynamic way?
And I'm also hearing you in talking about quantum integral medicine, are you familiar with the work of Stephen Walensky on quantum psychology?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's also been pretty inspiring for me,
uh-huh.
where he actually talks about how to work with your own states of mind
mm-hmm.
and to be able to go back and perhaps retrieve some of this remembered wellness.
Uh-huh.
One of the other things, considering the war and unfortunately the torture and pollution and polarization actually between segments of our population, this does affect us non-locally. I try to listen to Rush Limbaugh sometimes just mm-hmm. so I can understand what a person who has a very different approach to my normal way of thinking, how they are showing up in the world, how they are, and perhaps some allopathic physicians have also a similarly, I'm not saying they're like Rush Limbaugh or something, but that they have a similarly polarized
mm-hmm.
Way or polarized approach. But how do we deal with this polarization in our bodies?
Uh-huh.
That is in the field of humanity.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Anthony. In quantum theory, quantum vision, and in complexity theory too, mm-hmm. it's known that we are continually evolving to higher levels of existence. But talking about people like Rush Limbaugh, we wonder what level of existence he's evolving to, in a way. Or
well,
what.
And I think he certainly has a momentum, and mm-hmm. he's found it to be useful to him at a certain point. And yet, again, one wonders about not only how a person who has a narrowed viewpoint
mm-hmm.
can be invited to expand that viewpoint, but also what effect that person has with that narrow viewpoint on the whole field.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a fascinating point. It's like talking about the influence of one thing on many. In chaos theory is the famous butterfly effect,
right,
that
right.
a little butterfly flapping its wings in China can cause a hurricane in Florida. And I knew that when we were in the rush to war of a few years ago into Iraq, when all this talk was, oh, we'll go in there and make democracy happen, blah, 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 it'll be great. I knew one little thing happens, you open up Pandora's box. And that's what complexity and chaos theory tells you.
Right.
Pandora's box will always be open, even though you want to predict it. So our societal goings-on are also part and parcel of that same mindset of very linear thinking. As I was saying, these things are all self-perpetuated by these institutions. So the talk radio heads are continually, that's the way they think, and they're espousing it, and people are listening to it and picking up all the same verbiage.
I'm cautioned as a programmer on the radio, as we're drilling down into this, I'm cautioned to be mindful of the authority that people assign to something they hear over the radio.
Right.
So that just because it comes over the media, there is an unconscious assignment of authority to that.
Uh-huh.
And
right. I mean, you as a student of Zen know that Zen ultimately is about the liberation of the mind, freeing our mind from the dogmas and strictures we hold. And that's the thing. How can we question what we hear? But again, a part of that closed way of thinking doesn't question it. There was a very interesting experiment. It's a documentary film. And I saw it when I was in college a number of times, and I'll never forget it. It was, I don't know if you ever saw this or aware of it, but it was an experiment done with researchers, and they put a man in a chair and attached electrodes and things to him. And then they brought in the subjects, and they wanted the subjects to ask the man questions. And they told the subjects that if the man got the questions wrong, they would raise the voltage, give him little electroshocks.
Oh, right.
But the reality was there were no electric shocks, and the man in the chair was an actor. He was faking it. What they wanted to see was, would these people continue to ask questions as the man was telling them that the electricity was, he had a weak heart and was killing him. And so they would ask a question, he would get it wrong, they would raise the voltage, supposedly, and he would put on a little show. And they would keep doing it and doing it. And I don't know how many people, they did it for a lot of people, and they found about 3/4 of the people continued, even as the man was begging for his life, the subject said they had to keep giving it to him because they were told, don't listen to the man. The researcher was saying, don't listen to him, he's BSing you. And so
they were able to objectify that person.
Yeah, and so their real study was,
do
people listen to orders no matter what? Are they willing to ask questions and know when they should not do something?
So
it was very disturbing
findings. To take the moral authority upon oneself.
Right, and question what they're being told. And
right.
So really kind of take a quantum leap in thinking and be willing to not just take things at face value.
Well, that's been a curious point for me to explore with the last election.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot of momentum built in a particular direction, and many people chose to go along with that, but I don't know how consciously that choice was
uh-huh.
that they made.
Uh-huh.
But coming back to the healing of the whole field of being in a non-local way, another tenet of Zen is about being compassionate. So I can be compassionate with someone like Rush or someone who would have a narrow view because they happen to be in a state of ignorance. They're ignoring certain things, and they're making a choice about that, and that's affecting not only them, but it's affecting me. And yet, if I can be compassionate and patient and act in such a way that they are less likely to close down and retreat into their rock-solid absolutism, that's actually a kindness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about wholeness. How do we heal the whole?
Uh-huh.
The spelled W-H-O-L-E. I mean, you know,
uh-huh.
how do we bring that healing to the morphic field?
Uh-huh. Well, it's an interesting point about compassion, because I think we do have to feel unified with those we don't necessarily embrace, because part of this quantum vision, part of this sense of inclusiveness is not being separate, but feeling whole for all, feeling the unity of all. Sometimes that's a difficult thing for those who you don't feel strong about, and especially during election time, especially like last year when, mm-hmm. when the polarities get stronger and stronger. But at the same time, I talk in my book about the scientist, the logician Kurt Gödel, and his incompleteness theory, and why I talked about that, and I thought it's profound, and actually it's been called one of the most revolutionary findings of the 20th century, even though a lot of people don't understand it. But in the incompleteness theory, tells us basically that in a logical system, there's contradictions, and it can never be complete, and it's always finite. And to find the answer, you have to step outside the system. You have to take a little quantum jump. Gödel used the word quantum jump, but you have to take a little jump outside the system to find the answer. So pretty much you have to raise yourself and look, not down, but kind of look at it from a new perspective. You have to continually do that. So I think the answers to our turmoil and world lie in taking these quantum jumps, taking what I would call quantum creativity, seeing things more creatively, using logic, but in a more what you would call perhaps translogical standpoint. So you'll never be able to argue with Rush Limbaugh or any of those people at their level. You have to find a way to jump outside the system.
And how do I invite someone of that strong of a conviction to begin to explore what they're actually experiencing but may not have the terminology for, or may not have the way to think about that?
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, again, to talk about how you detail Western science actually drilling down into this new terrain and finding, yeah, guess what? Things are non-local. Guess what? There's a simultaneity, I guess, little by little. For example, when a patient comes to you and they've tried a lot of the allopathic models and they've got chronic pain, which you spoke about earlier, what do you recommend? Where do you start? Is there a protocol that you have?
Well,
for someone who's gone to the allopathic models and...
Which most people have. My approach is pretty individualistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, one, I want to try and build a resonance with the person, a rapport and a connection at the heart, at the body. And so, I mean, because for some people, all they really want is their pain taken away. They don't want to delve into, especially with chronic stuff,
right,
that tangled web that lies in us. Chinese medicine calls chronic diseases the knotty diseases because mm-hmm. it's considered a very tangled web with
K-N-O-T-T-Y, right?
Yeah, like a big knot.
But in a way, the people who really do find significant relief from these chronic states do have to go to letting go of who they thought they were. They have to expand their awareness beyond the limited sensibility that most Western people have of who they are.
That's the ultimate. We have to untangle the knot. You can't just push and pull. You have to, again, take that quantum Gödelian leap of kind of letting go, moving beyond. And that letting go, moving beyond, is what's considered a creative step, a creative emergence. And it's creative in that you don't exactly know where you're going to end up. And for us Westerners, with our egos and our desire to control and manipulate, that's a very tricky thing. But that's part of that. That's what I'm trying to get at. Sometimes I can verbalize it with people, and sometimes right. I can't, because I have to get a feel for what I can, how I can work with them, that dance.
Well, and how they're receptive.
How they're receptive.
You can't speak about quantum integral medicine to Rush Limbaugh.
No.
Because not to say that he's an unintelligent person, but he just hasn't gotten the foundation or come to a point of welcoming such a radical alternative just yet. But I have emphasized the word yet.
Yeah. Well,
there's always hope, you know.
Yeah.
So when you work with a person, you have to speak in their language and to approach logically in a way that they can receive.
Right.
Yet you may be doing something significantly deeper into the fabric of their energy field. Is that right?
Right. We are multidimensional beings. We exist on an energetic level, a physical level, a spiritual level, an emotional level, a cognitive intellectual level. So what I'm also trying to do is, one, I think true healing, we have to tap into a number of those things. And so I'm looking to see where I can find my entry point into someone. Also, speak their language, find out where they can go, how deep or wide their boundaries are, and can we expand the boundaries?
And do you find people with whom it's very difficult to find an entry point?
I mean, one, some people's immune systems have been compromised by the amount of drugs they take, and their minds are hardened, so that's tricky. Then we just sometimes I just want to laugh with them. We're trying to just use humor. I mean, Norman Cousins showed what humor did for his terminal illness. So humor just kind of gives those sparks. Humor is such a wonderful thing for creating those little quantum leaps in thinking. It kind of lets us drop. So sometimes that's all I'll do, or I'm always talking to them about their family, just finding the personal issues, something that will help them drop their guard and find a way that to find an entry point if they'll allow it to happen.
It's very curious that people in our culture, in our Western culture right now, are so guarded in a way. And I do think that that reflects in the
fear.
In the immune system.
Yeah.
Well, in fear, my gosh, it puts out all sorts of acute and chronic or immediate and long-term responses, such as the corticosteroids and the adrenal, you know, and in the adrenaline. Adrenaline's fine when you got to get out of the way of the saber-tooth tiger, but if that adrenaline is continually aroused, it can lead to a lot of difficulty, and I'm sure that you find that.
Yeah, and that's why Herbert Benson coined the phrase the relaxation response as a way to, you know, we know this, the fight or flight response, so how can we tap into that response that taps into our remembered wellness?
Can you speak a bit more about the remembered wellness as you know it?
Right. Well, as I was talking about before, and I wanted, when I talk about it in my book also, I tie it into both quantum thought and complexity theory, in that, and complexity theory has a term called self-organizing principle.
Right.
And so remembered wellness, innate in our bodies, is a quantum vision, a remembered wellness, and a self-organizing principle. They're pretty much one and the same. And what that is our bodies, our cells, our energy, our subatomic empty space has a desire towards perfection, towards spreading out towards infinity, like we talked about the quantum world where all matter in wave form spreads out infinitely. So that is ingrained in our body. That is who informs us, what makes us up. And it's a movement towards perfection, towards self-organizing, towards higher states of being, evolving towards higher states of existence. So remembered wellness is, I think, fundamentally is that our body is moving towards organizing towards higher states of wellness, but it doesn't just happen, doesn't always happen just naturally on its own. And plus, because we're so willing to pollute our bodies with either food, chemicals, drugs, we've lost sight of even how to cultivate it. And that's when people have deep and profound healings, mm-hmm. so-called spontaneous healings, they're also tapping into that the depths of their soul, the quantum vision, their remembered wellness. Mm-hmm. The placebo effect is maligned by the drug company and the Western medicine, because especially the drug companies hate it, because when the placebo effect does better than the drugs in the trials, oftentimes the drug companies have to go back to the drawing board, and sometimes they won't be allowed to bring the drugs out onto the market. So that's quite an embarrassment to them, because then we're saying, well, what are the drugs doing if people can get better without even a drug?
Right. Well, and yet that's such a curiously absolutist response, too. What would you recommend with people who have to be in a difficult environment, either from people in the family who have narrow viewpoints, or living in a city, or from dealing at work with a boss or coworker who is difficult to deal with, because that can very directly affect one's health.
Uh-huh.
And even in the way that work is structured today, many people are doing 2 and 3 times the work that they ought to be doing.
Uh-huh.
You know, what are your, do you have some recommendations about
that? Yeah, I would say two things. First, from my work, I did an internship a few years ago at the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, which was started by Jon Kabat-Zinn, still exists at the University of Mass Medical School. And it was a profound experience, and it's a clinic where they teach people how to be more mindful in your everyday life and deal with your stress better. Because stress, we all have stress, but it's really our relationship to the stressors that really affect us. So number one is, if we become more mindful of that situation, that stressful situation, and not reactive, we have the potential to deal with it better and not let us affect you. Some schools of meditation say the best place to meditate is in the middle of a noisy city, because you learn how to just kind of unify with that. Right. And so in the integral viewpoint, one of the things of the integral viewpoint is, if you can raise your thinking, your consciousness to a higher level and see God in everything, perhaps you want to use that word, you can just put yourself in the middle of a city and just really unify with that and be more mindful of it. So that's one option, if people can really understand how to unify and just be more mindful of their reactions. And then for others, the second option for others who that's just still not going to work is to take that Gödelian quantum leap and find a way out of the system. If your job is making you ill, or your work is depressing you, mm-hmm. you may, and option number one isn't going to happen, isn't working, then you may have to find the way out of that. As I said, Gödelian logic is, there are limits to our finite world, our world of logic and rational thinking, and so sometimes you have to take the step. And that option is, chaos will ensue if you choose to go outside the beaten path, take the road less taken.
That's very scary.
Right. And chaos theory says that all of life is chaos. Life is random, as the Apple computer ads are saying. But life is random and chaos. But out of that chaos comes new order. And that's been shown out of chaos theory.
I think that's
There's
really
always
important
new order.
To remember.
Right. Always new order that occurs from chaos. So are we willing to take that step into the dark side or something, the unknown, not knowing where it's going to lead, but on the next step we will come to a new order. Anthony, you mentioned I mentioned the Type M miracle personality, and
right.
Let me just see if I find it. I wrote down what one researcher wrote about that personalities of people who the Type miracle personalities. And one of the things he talked about was active surrender, saying that one patient exclaimed that his surrender was predicated on his understanding that life sometimes just is, and the universe doesn't arrange itself around my ego. And then another, there were six different things, and then another one was social change, that self-healers undergo a change in their interpersonal relationships. They realize that their relationship with others plays a role in their illness, and they make either an intentional or accidental change for the better. You know, some would say there's no accidents, but they realize that there, as I was saying, that option one of becoming more mindful in your situation may not work. So option two of just understanding the toxicity of all these things, and then you have to take that little jump beyond. And that's why when people go through strong healings, profound healings, they're profound because they don't just heal physically, but they heal emotionally and spiritually. They heal on a very deep level. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it means severing ties in relationships or work or something, but knowing that it's just caused very, very difficult things for the person.
But I think, you know, one of the things in being able to do that is to become conscious that there is the disharmony there.
Mm-hmm.
To say, gosh, something isn't right here. What choice can I make to do it? And sometimes people feel real boxed in. Well, that box can be a gift in stepping out of that. I think it's all too easy for people to remain in a toxic situation where they have chosen to be unmindful of the toxicity,
mm-hmm.
and then the corresponding toxicity shows up as chronic illness.
Right. Yeah, we're a product of our environment, and again, we can't think we're a victim. We can't just say, oh, that's the way life happens, and that's just the way it is. We always have that choice to make that quantum leap.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have a book. It's called, and it was about cancer, and it's called Civilization is the Illness, Cancer is the Cure, meaning it's really, in complexity theory, we talk about a complex adaptive system that we adapt to our environment. So what I was saying is civilization is toxic, and cancer is a complex adaptive system. It's a way of adapting. You know, I don't mean that in a harsh way,
mm-hmm.
but cancer could be a pathway for a person to achieve a new order, because cancer is chaos. But cancer can lead to a new order. And the people I've met who've healed from cancer usually have very, you know, they're just very wise. They've just, their life has really gone through very profound changes.
Yeah. Well, we're about at the end here. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And is there some closing thoughts that you have?
Well, one, again, I hope people would be interested in my book, Quantum Integral Medicine Towards a New Science of Healing and Human Potential.
What's the 800 number again?
It's 800-431-1579. That's through Book Clearinghouse, the distributor. Or you can find it online booksellers or in bookstores. Or you can go to ithinkbooks.com or my website, quantumintegralcenter.com. But ultimately, where I'm hoping this takes me, because on my website you'll see about information about a training program, but where I'm hoping this takes me is to the forefront of what I consider quantum creativity. Because I think if we start understanding these new sciences, how it blends with spirituality, it can lead to an emergence or a shifting of the mind to greater capabilities of using our mind and body in greater levels. And that's what I call quantum creativity, which I think can lead us to a new renaissance of activity. We may not be able to change the Rush Limbaughs of the world, but we can do our own. We can just take that quantum leap, move forward with our own vision. Because I think ultimately our world needs more statesmen, people with strong vision. And to do that, you really need to see the world in a more creative, from a creative thinking perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Anthony.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.